Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman. A weekly psychic fusion of forward thoughts, far-out ideas, magical foray, and spellbinding song. Stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
In 1947, there was a film called The Red Shoes about a ballerina who chose to dance over marrying and having a family. And in the film, the ballerina, who is beautiful and delicate, is asked by a dandified man who is all dressed up in scarves and coattails, "Why do you want to dance? Why do you insist on this madness?" And she replies, "Why do you want to live?" And he says, "Well, I don't know why exactly. I just must." And she says, "That is my answer also." There is something about creative life that is reaching down into the hottest water with the tenderest of hands, trying to extract that one sterling piece of material that clearly lays on its side at the bottom. It's finding that one thin lens in a plush rug. It's sometimes a disaster. The creative work feels like you've just arrived a moment too late, or that you've just drank milk that's just one day too old, and it's a disaster, as though there's no chemistry, the humiliation of not being successful. But at its root, creativity is not about success and not about failure. It's not about knowing why or what or even who. It's a mystery. And it is a spiritual practice to live the creative center in our everyday life. It's like living near a ripe field that is constantly growing and developing, bringing forth fruit and dying away and coming back again. And the creative life means that there are no censors in the usual sense, that closets are ripped open within the psyche, that walks are taken that were formerly forbidden, that cures for various malaises are brought up from the deep unconscious. If a person follows the creative life, they will have sometimes bad things to say, names to call people that they care for, unpopular ideas to spread. And it's never too late to live this life that is truthful and real. But some people, rather than having a hovering presence in the psyche that leads them into the deeper parts of creative life, have instead a Judas sheep. That's the name of the sheep in the slaughterhouse that leads the other sheep to the killing floor. They have something in the psyche that attempts to slaughter the inner life. There is an element in the psyche that is death-like, that is a very important part of the creative process, because it not only in myths and fairy tales, usually personified by an old woman, it not only draws things into death, but incubates them and releases them back into life again. There's a story called The Corpse Bride that was given to me by Joanne Greenberg. And it's about a young man who travels with his two companions on the way to the young man's wedding. And they stop by the side of a river at night, and they make a campsite there. And as they are lying beside the fire, having eaten some of their bread and soup they've brought with them, they notice that there's a root sticking up out of the ground. And the bridegroom goes over and looks at it closely and says, "Why, it's a bony finger that's sticking up out of the ground." And on impulse, he takes the gold ring out of his pocket that is meant for his bride. And without further thought, he puts it upon the bony finger sticking out of the ground. And his companions laugh, and he laughs, and in all the laughter, he begins to do a little dance around the finger sticking out of the ground that now has the golden wedding ring upon it. And as he does the little dance and he and his friends laugh even more, he begins to sing the marriage song. Haren yat bitabai hat Moshe v'Yisrael. And he sings this three times as he circles in his dance around the bony finger with the golden ring on it. And all of a sudden, the ground begins to shake. And all of a sudden, up out of the grave sits the corpse bride, and she's dressed in a long white gown that is covered with dirt and spider eggs, and she has worms that are hanging from her hair, and where she used to have pearls across the bodice of her gown, now all is torn away and her rib cage is exposed. And the bridegroom is taken aback. Oh my God! And his friends as well. And they turn on their heels and they run and they run and they run and they run to the village where the bride is. And they run to the rabbi. "Rabbi, rabbi," says the bridegroom, "could I ask you a question? If you are on your way to a wedding, and if you are camping down by the river, and if there is a root sticking out of the ground, and you put a golden ring that was meant for your bride to be upon that root sticking out of the ground, and it turns out actually to be a finger sticking out of the ground, and if you circle around that finger sticking out of the ground with a wedding ring upon it three times, and if you pronounce the wedding vow and sing it aloud as you go around that finger sticking out of the ground with a golden ring upon it, Rabbi, is that a valid marriage?" And the rabbi says, "Well, I've never quite heard such a story before. Pray tell, who are you asking for?" "Oh, no one you know, Rabbi. We were just wondering. We were just having a scholarly, intellectual discussion." And the rabbi said, "Well, I think that..." And at that moment, the door slammed open to the small room, and in staggered the corpse bride. And the rabbi was horrified, and the hair stood up on the back of everyone's neck. And she pointed a bony finger at the bridegroom, and she said, "I demand my wedding night." And the bridegroom backed into the corner, and the rabbi said, "Oh, is this the friend of whom you were speaking?" And the bridegroom nodded his head violently. And the rabbi said, "This is a very serious problem. I must confer with the other rabbis. This issue is too great for one person's mind alone." And so the rabbi withdrew, and the bridegroom and his friends huddled outside. And the corpse bride stood at one end of the porch, tapping her toe and folding and unfolding her gloves. The rabbi came out once and said, "May I ask you a question, a clarifying question? Was that gold ring you put on her finger truly a gold ring, truly solid gold?" And the bridegroom said, "Yes, it was." And the rabbi shook his head, sadly, and went back into the room with the other rabbis. And a little while later, he came out again. I said, "I need to ask another question of clarification. Did you dance around the finger with a golden ring on it? And did you repeat the marriage vow in its entirety?" And the bridegroom hung his head and said, "Yes, I did." And the rabbi shook his head and went back into the room. And meanwhile, the living bride, the true bride, came onto the scene and wanted to know what all the flurry was about. And the bridegroom did not want to tell her, but she prodded and she poked and she cajoled until finally he spilled the whole story out and she collapsed in tears. "Oh, my life is over. What shall I do? Everything I had dreamed and hoped for is dashed." And at that moment, all the rabbis filed out in their dark hats and their dark coats, and they all lined up in front of the corpse bride, the bridegroom, his two friends, and the living bride. "Well, we have convened, and we have made an inquiry, and we have decided, from the best of all these scholarly minds." And at that, the bridegroom leaned forward, and his friends also, and the living bride. "And we have decided," continued the rabbi, "that since you brought a gold ring to the river, and since you put it upon the finger of a corpse, and since that corpse rose up out of the earth and demanded her wedding night because you circled around her in a dance and repeated the marriage vow in its entirety, we have decided that even so, the dead have no claim upon the living." And at that moment, the bridegroom jumped up into the air, rejoicing, and the corpse bride fell down in agony. "Oh," she cried, "oh, everything and anything I ever wanted and ever wanted to live for in my entire life, any chance of it whatsoever, is gone." And the living bride, seeing this, was filled with a profound feeling of helplessness, but also sorrow and pity and compassion. And she rushed over to the corpse bride and lifted her. She was so light because she was only bones. And she lifted her in her arms. And she rocked her a little bit and she said, "Do not fear. I will live the life for you that you wanted for yourself. I will bring your dreams into the world so that you can rest in peace." And the living bride stepped out into the forest and walked down to the river with the corpse bride in her arms, with the corpse bride's dress trailing in the grasses. And in a shallow grave at the river's edge, she laid her as though she were a baby. And the light gradually went out of the corpse bride's eyes. And the living bride said, "Go to sleep. Go to sleep. Sleep well. Sleep long. And be at peace. I will live out the dreams that you had. I will live the life that you wanted. Sleep now." And so the corpse bride was returned to the earth, and the bridegroom much wiser, and the living bride grown far more compassionate and wise as well, were married in a joyous ceremony. And this time, the golden ring was put on the finger, the living finger of the living bride. And the dance was made, and the marriage vow repeated, and all was well. This story can be understood in this way. In reality, in Europe, in Russia, and other parts of the world, sometimes during the pogroms against the Jews, Jewish wedding parties actually were waylaid by anti-Semites. And the bride, because she was able to bear children, was torn from the wagon and murdered and buried in her wedding gown. There's something both in the outer and the inner world that would like to cut off the dreams and hopes of people, things, and impulses that are in some way perceived as different, and sometimes even that are perceived as holy or sacred, but in a different kind of way. There is a symbology to this particular story that is beyond the external. And it has to do with the unconscious marriage to something that has been ruined or harmed beyond repair. In creative life, this can occur as a result of an act, you might say, of spiritual homicide on the part of the creating person who destroys their own work. I remember going to a painter's house in Taos, a friend who painted beautiful landscapes and who was experimenting in a different medium than their usual, and laid out on the studio table next to his tabouret, I saw a beautiful, beautiful landscape painting with a word written upon it in red paint. It said, "This is shit." And there's something in his psyche that could not allow the work to be just what it was, just to live its life as it was, even though it may not have measured up immediately to what he had hoped, but to allow it to live regardless. But instead, he had murdered it by making it into something that clearly reflected his hatred of it. So, in The Corpse Bride, the redeeming element has to do with the living bride. She is the one who says, "I will live out the dreams of that which has been murdered. I will live out the life, the immense life that was never lived before." And many people who were little children in generations past were told, for instance, that there was only one way to create, that trees were only green, that houses always had chimneys, and that all people had five fingers on each hand, and so on and so forth. And if they drew anything that was different than that, they were chastised in one way or another. However, the children who painted pink and purple trees were absolutely right. Because if you observe carefully, which is part of the creative process, is deep observation. If you observe carefully in the forest, in the springtime, before the leaves are completely on the trees, a walk through the forest will show you unequivocally that some tree bark is palest lavender, and that some is blonde colored, and that many tree trunks are pale green. And even the trunks of standard maples and elms and oaks are not brown, but are darkest gray, mixed with hundreds of shades of silver, with speckles. So the child, playing the piano who's pecking out the melody of a song with one finger, and a person who knows how to play the piano formally and ritualistically, comes along and says, "No, no, you have to use all fingers of each hand. And the hands have to be held exactly like this, with the fingers curved over the keys." But if you closely observe with the artistic eye, with the creative eye, the observing self, if you watch pianists who play with Rose Maddock or Wanda Jackson, or the musical eruptions of Little Richard, or the sway and stomp of Alberta Hunter, that old drooping lip blues singer, none of them hold their hands right. And thank God for that. A child's creative flow is interrupted when demands for status quo or format come too soon, or when it's touted as, "This is the only proper way." And this develops something within the psyche that murders the bride, that says, "You are not allowed to live. You are not allowed to reproduce. You are not allowed to live out your dreams because you're not doing it right. You're not doing it the way that I want you to." As you know, if you have children, many children love to draw cartoons or high fashion models or design clothes, or they like to draw cars or warplanes or airplanes and that sort of thing. And maybe their planes don't look so much like planes at first. Or maybe ever. And maybe the clothes that they're designing don't look so spectacular. And perhaps someone, usually a grown-up, says, "You know, you really don't have any talent for drawing, honey." And immediately, whoosh, the bride is murdered. Which later on in the child's life gives absolute permission to that child, now grown up, to kill things off and devalue all creative output and to go right ahead and be that which murderizes the creative acts. So the more a person hears these kinds of comments when they're children, the more complexes develop and grow. Even one's peers when one is a child will augment this destruction to a certain extent by, you know how children jeer one another and make fun of one another sometimes. "Oh, look, he made a funny picture, you know. He's painting the sky purple. Oh, isn't that stupid? Isn't that silly?" I remember a very talented child I went to school with, and everything about him was not the usual, including his size, which was farmhand enormous, including his name, which was Delmar, spelled as two names, and including that he had an Anglo father and a Mexican mother. It was a hard set of circumstances for him. And I remember the teacher deriding him because he colored a mountain brilliant orange. "There are no orange mountains," I remember the teacher saying sarcastically. But many, many years later, when both he and I, in separate journeys, migrated from the upper Midwest to Taos, New Mexico, we sat on the plaza one day sharing a warm Coca-Cola, and as it became later and later in the day, Lobo Peak, that loomed over us, turned first maroon-colored, then fresh blood red, and finally fiery orange. And we looked at each other, and we said, "Do you remember? Do you remember?" And we both did, and we laughed, and we laughed until Delmar cried. And I patted his hand and patted his hand and patted his hand, because what he was experiencing in that moment was a reliving of the murder that took place years before. And also, hopefully, somewhere in his psyche was the living bride who was coming to his aid with compassion and saying, "I'm going to live now. I'm going to live your hopes and dreams. And as you know, Taos, New Mexico, is a place where artists come and work and live. And as far as I know, Delmar is still there. And he has become a successful artist who paints many, many orange mountains, many, many purple skies, many, many pink tree trunks. And that's as it should be. In the story, The Corpse Bride, the compassion that the living bride feels for the corpse bride, you see, no one wants to touch her. As soon as she erupts from the earth, and we see what condition, what murdered condition she's in, and what deteriorated condition she's in, the bridegroom doesn't want to face her. The rabbis want to decide things intellectually about who's married to whom and what's legal and what's not. The friends have no compassion toward her. The only one that has compassion is the living bride, and only when the corpse bride collapses, when she is at her weakest, when it is very clear that she cannot hold herself up, that she has nothing left to live for. And it's at that moment that the living bride is filled with a feeling of what you might call the death mother. In fairy tales and folklore, the death mother is the one, such as the banshee, for instance, who comes and lays the living who are in the midst of their dying down into the underworld, who takes them, leads them there, puts them at rest, puts them at peace. And in that moment of that collapse, the living bride moves forward and says, "We are not separate from one another. I am connected to you. You are a part of me and I am a part of you. And I will harvest, so to speak, your dreams and your hopes from you, and I will carry them forward." And this is precisely what has to happen in order for us to have a rich creative life. We have to be able to stand the things that are deteriorative. We have to be able to stand the things that are not in the best condition or the best of shape. We have to be able to lay it down and let it die, or in some cases, be energized by it. In Mexico, we have a saying that if muerte, if death comes and sits beside you, you are lucky, because death has chosen to teach you something. Something that is wise and something that is productive. And so in The Corpse Bride, even though the living bride did not solicit muerte to show up, death showed up anyway. And as a result, many things are changed and transformed. In fairy tales, in analytical psychology, we look at every aspect of the fairy tale as representing one part of the human psyche, of an individual psyche, so that in this particular tale, the corpse bride, the friends, the bridegroom, the rabbis, and the living bride all represent a part of one person's psyche and how those parts interact with one another.
Thank you. at the cards, are on the table. In this place called Sugar Land.
Searching, trying to find my way.
I have to find myself.
So I am standing at the end of the crossroad, trying to find myself.
Standing.
And how could I tell you? Because you don't really know. See, I have to find myself. And I want to be alone. You see me standing. Don't ask me where I'm going. Because I am not going that way. Because I am trying to find my place where I'm supposed to be.
To me, I know, but I tried to tell you, but you look at me like maybe I'm an angel underneath, innocent and sweet. I'm a bitch, I'm a lover, I'm a child, I'm a mother, I'm a sinner, I'm a saint. I do not feel ashamed. Yesterday I cried. You must have been relieved to see the softer side. I can understand how you'd be so confused. I don't envy you. I'm a little bit of everything, all rolled into one. I'm a bitch, I'm a lover, I'm a child, I'm a mother, I'm a sinner, I'm a saint. I do not feel ashamed. I'm your hell, I'm your dream, I'm nothing.
Must be the season.
For the season.
Oh, shoot, object to crave. But you, you're not allowed. You're uninvited and unfortunate. Slight. Must be strangely exciting to watch the stoic squirm. Must be somewhat heartening to watch it burn, meet shepherd. But you, I don't think you unworthy. I need a moment to deliberate.
When I said it out loud, it wasn't as strong as it was in my head. I tried not to think about it, so it came back louder. Became a snob, decided not to play along, so it grew bigger. Me and my head have become very, very, very close. We decided not to tell you, to tell you about it. We're just gonna play it safe, do what we know, play it cool, lay low, not tell you about it. And here I am playing by myself, me and my superiority complex.
Real good time. as programmable soda. Too much cherry, baby, then you can. Just a cooler, think of me as programmable soda. Cause you can be a cool fella. So okay, then I just bag up the vanilla. Think of me as programmable soda. Cause I've come to accept that for loving you are a funny day. But I can't let that throw me into a genitude.
On the other side, rainbows are visions, but only illusions, and rainbows have nothing to hide. So we've been told, and some choose to believe it. I know they're wrong, wait and see. Someday we'll find it, the rainbow connection, the lovers, the dreamers, and me. Who said that wishes would be heard and answered when wished on the morning star? Someone believed it, and look what it's done so far. What's so amazing that keeps us stargazing, and what do we think we might see? Someday we'll find it, the rainbow. Lovers, the dreamers, and me, all of us under its spell. We know that it's probably magic. Have you been sleeping? And have you heard voices? I've heard them. Calls the young sailors, the voice might be one and the same. I've heard it too many times to ignore it. It's something that I'm supposed to be. Someday.
The
dreamers.
Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman, a weekly psychic fusion of forward thoughts, far out ideas, magical foray, and spellbinding song, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.